Welcome everyone to Teaching Peace in Schools, Cultivating Restorative School Communities. Tonight, or in relationship to wherever you are coming in from, it could be a different time of the day, welcome. This is Session 8. Believe it or not, we are already at Session 8 out of 10 for our 10-week overview course series. And we sure hope that you're getting a lot out of it and making use of all of the resources that are posted on your participant page, which is peacealliance.org/teach-course-page. Password, peace is the way. We hope that you're enjoying the audio presentations coupled with the slide presentations and the various resources that each of our faculty have provided and handpicked for you. Again, as this being an overview, we've been looking at restorative justice and practices in schools. We've been looking at how to actually implement, and a lot of us probably have been just understanding more of how it might relate to our local needs, as well as looking at NVC, mindfulness, and social-emotional learning. And of course, we all, I'm guessing, know that we teach what we need to learn. I know that's true for me. And so as your host, again, Molly Rowan Leach is my name, and it's an honor and pleasure to be here with you as a global learning community. I serve as Restorative Justice Fellow for the Peace Alliance, and I also have a great relationship with the wonderful people at the National Association for Community and Restorative Justice, that's NACRJ.org. The Peace Alliance and NACRJ have done incredible work partnering to co-host this and make this 10-week overview course possible. So thank you very much to both those organizations. I also would like to mention that I am host and executive producer and founder of Restorative Justice on the Rise, which is a secondary host of this overview course. And if you're interested in more information about Restorative Justice on the Rise, it's a hub for resources. It's a library pointing you to some incredible books on the subject and related subjects in peacebuilding and restorative practices. And that's at restorativejusticeontherise.org. Once again, thank you for making this learning community such a rich experience. All of you are coming from different places and levels of understanding, and they're all relevant. And we hope that, again, this overview has provided you something that you've been looking for and needing. And we also hope that you might stick with us in the future as we offer a 201 level course in some of these areas, as well as intensives with some of the particular faculty. And I promise to have more information about that for you very soon. Of course, next week's class will be with Fania Davis. Fania, of course, is sister to Angela and stands very much on her own in service to the Oakland community of youth and works with schools there with Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth. She will be our guest faculty next week. That's April 7th at our same time slot here that we have kept all along, 5 p.m. Pacific for 90 minutes. So before I introduce tonight's guest faculty and the topic we're going to cover, just a note about tonight's conversation. As with all of our times together, if you would like to get involved in the conversation before we pause for questions, you can always press 1 on your telephone keypad. And tonight does have a visual presentation, so make sure that you are accessing your screen share link in order to view the slide presentation that our guest faculty has created for tonight's session. Tonight's session is, of course, with Lauren Abramson. Dr. Lauren Abramson, or Lauren Abramson, PhD. She's with the Community Conferencing Center in Baltimore, Maryland. You can find out everything you want to know about this incredible organization at communityconferencing.org. The title of tonight's session, we've been promoting it as Urban Schools, Evolution of Restorative Practice Over 2 Decades in Baltimore. and a subtitle of Restorative Practices, a Biological Imperative for Our Time. Lauren is a psychologist with 20 years of experience with restorative practices, and she's currently the founder and executive director of the Community Conferencing Center, which, as I noted, is located in Baltimore, Maryland. And I've recommended highly to everyone, if you have not yet seen it, Fixing Juvie Justice was a recent PBS documentary that featured the work of Lauren and her team at the Community Conferencing Center. It's a very moving, inspiring, and informative documentary. So if you have not yet seen that, I highly recommend it. That's called Fixing Juvie Justice. Lauren brought community conferencing to Baltimore in 1995, and she's been providing conferencing and other restorative practices, services, and training in Baltimore's courts, schools, neighborhoods, and organizations. The successes of Community Conferencing Center over the past 18 years speak to the power and potential of this work in highly distressed communities in America's large cities. With the increasing pressure for schools to use restorative practices, Lauren has been working to preserve restorative practice as a values-based approach, as opposed to a plug-and-play set of techniques. Lauren has published articles which help elucidate both theoretical and practical aspects of restorative practices. So without further ado, welcome Lauren Abramson. So great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Molly. It's really wonderful to be here, and I just so appreciate the work that you do to make these kinds of things. I've known you now for maybe 3 or 4 years, and your work is just so important in terms of getting the word out from so many different people to so many different people. So I really appreciate what you do, and I appreciate the work of the Peace Alliance and NACRJ and the other organizations and people that make this possible. So I'm excited to hear from folks who are out there listening to this. What I hope to do is just give you a sense of what we've been doing in Baltimore for the past 20 years and to give you a sense of where it comes from and something that I've appreciated more and more as time goes on is really the lineage that I am part of and that from where I got this work. And so it's going to be a little bit different maybe for folks because part of where I'm coming from is really I come at this work as somebody who has studied neuroscience and animal behavior, and I really, when I first learned about this in 1994 from David Moore, the Australian David Moore who came here, and when I heard him, this work just struck me as being rooted in our biology. And so what I want to do is start off with a little bit of a personal perspective. It is Thursday, and those of you who are online can see this photograph, this Throwback Thursday photograph of me in fifth grade in Detroit. And that I grew up in Detroit is a big part of me. I've really become quite imprinted on Rust Belt cities. You can't see me, but my picture is in the upper right-hand corner. And so this experience that I had growing up in Motown was just so significant for me. As everybody probably knows, Detroit used to be the center of the auto industry. And the perspective that gave me, I think, is important for understanding the restorative justice work that we're doing. And to put that in perspective, I really like the quote by David Simon, who was one of the co-creators of the HBO series The Wire, which is based in Baltimore. I hope that some of you have seen it because the work that we do is done largely in the kinds of neighborhoods that are depicted in that show. And this quote was adapted from Winston Churchill, and he says, David Simon says we're shaped by the institutions that govern us. And I think it's really important for us to understand our current institutions and how are they shaping us based on how well are they working for us as human beings. So what I'm showing you here is actually a picture of the Packard plant. This was the auto plant in Detroit in the 1950s. It's obviously a vibrant place of employment and work. And this is a picture of the Packard plant now in Detroit with its devastation. And I think that that's one example of how our means of employment and our economy is really not working for a lot of people. And there's a book that has been really important to me, which is by Grace Lee Boggs, who, when she was 96, wrote this book called The Next American Revolution. And Grace Lee Boggs had been a labor organizer in Detroit in the 50s and a civil rights activist in the 60s and worked up until, I believe, last year is when she passed away at 100. But what Grace Lee Boggs says is that the next American Revolution is not going to be about equality. But the next American Revolution is going to be about who we are as human beings. And I think that that's a fundamental question for us doing restorative justice work. Who are we now? And how are the way our institutions, how the way that those are shaped, how are they shaping us? And what I want to pose to folks is that what we've done with our institutions of justice, our institutions of education, our workplaces, is that we've leached out of them ways, the fundamental ways of being human and humane. And part of that has to do with our biology. And what I really think is important that if we're going to take restorative practices seriously, that we really need to understand who we are biologically as mammals, as primates, and embed that into our practice. So one of the really important ways that we are, that distinguishes us as mammals, is that we are biologically built to be connected with each other. Just to, not to overly, I love the science part of it, and I'm not sure how much other people do, but I just want to give folks a sense of how our brain evolved, because basically we've got three brains that evolved one on top of the other. We've got a reptilian brain that governs basic functions like breathing, sleeping, procreating. And then on top of that grew the limbic system. And with the limbic system, we got mammals. And what is unique about the limbic system is that that's when we develop pair bonding. Reptiles do not bond with their young, but mammals do. And on top of that limbic system is what's called the new brain. So we've got the reptilian brain, which is basically instinct, the emotional mammalian brain, which is the limbic system, which is where we get emotions and where we get empathy. And then we get the intellect and creativity with our new brain. And I feel that what we've leached out too much from our education system, from our justice system, is that sense of connection and our ability to be emotional. But I just want to show these pictures so that we get a sense of what it feels like and how important it is to be connected, because that's who we are biologically. And what I'd like to do is play this video, which you cannot hear, but this is a capuchin monkey who is tending to a bunch of puppies who are squealing, and you're not going to be able to hear them. Actually, I think I'm going to have to, I'm not going to play for some reason. But the point really that I want to make with that is that when we are in connection with each other, we are healthy. And when we are in disconnection or in unhealthy connection, we are in a state of disease or disease. And what restorative practices is really all about is creating structures so that we can be connected with each other. And so what I want to do is just go through, I know that you've, in the other presentations, you've done restorative, gone through restorative practices and their values. But I really, you know, they say that you have to learn, you have to go over something 6 times before we really learn it. And I think we all have a little bit of a different slant on it. But what I find so important about restorative practices is that relationships are fundamentally valued and relationships matter. And with education, by ignoring relationships, which when we're so focused on testing, and we see over and over and over again teachers who are so frustrated because they really want to connect with things that are going on with their students. And in Baltimore, like many cities and many other places, kids are really struggling with serious, serious things that are going on in their lives. And teachers feel like they don't have time to connect with what's going on in kids' lives. And what I would like to put forward is that by ignoring that, we are limiting these kids' ability to learn and academically, and we're limiting their ability to learn just basic social skills. Another value that I think is so important to restorative practices is that we're providing ways that empower people to make decisions for themselves. That way too often we don't give people a voice in making decisions. And by doing that, we're taking away people's incentive to be responsible for themselves, basically. And the other part of that is that we live in a culture that is so, we teach people to be so reliant on experts to do things for us. And what we're missing by telling people what to do, first of all, none of us want to be told what to do. But what we're missing is being able to access the wisdom that there is so much wisdom in our young people, and there is so much wisdom in teachers. And there is so few structures that allow that wisdom to emerge. The analogy that I like to use for how important it is for people to be able to make decisions for themselves comes from medicine. Most people know that, have seen somebody post-surgically that you have that little clicker that allows you to manage your own pain medicine. Well, those didn't exist all the time, but in the 70s, people in medicine realized that if they gave patients the ability to administer their own pain medicine when they needed it, that people actually used less medicine and got more pain relief. And I think it's the same thing that when harm is done, if we pull together the people that are affected by it and let them make decisions for themselves about how to fix it, that they're going to make better decisions and they're going to last longer than if somebody decides for them what they need to do. Another really important aspect and value of restorative practices is the idea of fair, that things need to be fair. And anybody who's raised a child knows that the first abstract concept that we have as human beings is our sense of fairness. We actually have that before we have verbal. Some of us have it before we have verbal abilities. And if I can, I don't know if this video, this might work. What you're going to see, you're not going to hear the sound, but I guess it's not. Yeah, sorry, that's not working again. But that's okay. I'll make these videos available so you can see that. But what you would see in that video is that Hans de Waal, who is an amazing primatologist, has an experiment where he shows two capuchin monkeys who are in a cage side by side. And they've trained them that they've got to give a stone outside the cage to the human being who's outside. And in exchange for that, they get a treat. And they're right next to each other, but they're in separate cages. And one of the monkeys gets a cucumber treat, and the other one does the same task and gets a grape treat. Well, the monkeys know that a grape is way more delicious than the cucumber. So the first monkey gives the human the stone and in exchange gets a cucumber, which it eats. It's very happy to eat the cucumber. And the monkey right next door does the same thing and gets a grape. Well, the one next door saw this other one get a grape, and so they do the task again and give the person, the human, a stone. And the human gives them a cucumber. And immediately, this monkey throws the cucumber at the human and starts shaking the cage in rage. Like, I want the grape! And then to me, this is just a powerful and actually a really emotional example of how it feels for us to be basically subjected to processes that are not fair. And I think with regard to in schools, how we address harm, that we don't appreciate the importance of there being a sense of fairness. And the other part that I think is very important, a very important value of restorative practices, that is part of our biology, which I appreciate more and more as I do this work, is that I think it is fundamentally human, a human need for us to want to tell our story. And when we don't allow a space for young people to be heard and to tell their story and to share their experience, I think we're doing great damage and we're really limiting their aliveness to learning. And the other piece is that what we need to be incorporating, and this is the thing that really got me into doing this work, is that we need to be allowing us to be emotional beings. And I'm gonna run through the very important aspect of the biology of emotion in a second. So I'm gonna say more about that in a second. And the last value is that every single person deserves to be treated with respect. I have gone into so many schools and seen the ways that adults justifiably are frustrated, but are just reacting to it in ways that are so disrespectful at times. And it's so challenging, and I really so respect what teachers do. And at the same time, if we are not modeling respect to our young people, we can't expect that back. So all of you have seen this basic structure of what restorative practices are, and what I think is important, we call it the with way, because if you've got two dimensions of one is how much support you're providing and the other is how much structure you're providing, we all know that if there's very little support but a lot of structure, that's the zero tolerance way of doing things. And I think this is what it breeds. It breeds this cat and mouse game and nobody learns anything. Because punishment tells us what not to do, but punishment tells us nothing about what to do. So the other dimension, another window in this is that if you've got a lot of support but no structure. That's a really permissive approach, and we see a lot of adults, especially in after-school programs, who really want to help kids and they want to give them opportunities, but they don't know how to set boundaries and set limits for behavior, and that's the permissive approach, which is like this. This kid blows up the garage, and the mother says, never, ever do that again. Well, that's not going to help that kid figure that out. And then, you know, if you've got no support and no structure, you're basically being neglectful. And so this is a sense, an example of being neglectful. And then we're looking for a situation where there is a significant amount of structure with a lot of support. And that's the with way, and that's the restorative way of handling things. So what we've done in Baltimore is for the past about 20 years, we've been offering the range of restorative practices, from dialogue circles in the classroom to restorative questions and restorative conversations, and then offering the responsive approach for serious harm to do community conferencing. And so I want to explain a little bit. This is one of the streets of Baltimore. I want to explain a little bit about the community conferencing process that we've been using. I learned about community conferencing from David Moore, who's an Australian. And he and John McDonald adapted this process from the Maori in New Zealand. So I like to say that what we do went from New Zealand to Australia to Baltimore in a straight line. And basically, this process is an adaptation of the family group conferences from the Maori. Because in the Maori culture, your family group are the people in your life, not just who you're related to by blood, but the people in your life who you care about and who care about you. And when something goes awry in the Maori culture, there's everybody who's been involved in and affected by the group, by the situation, and their family group members come together to resolve it. So we've been using this process that involves a trained and neutral facilitator. And when there's an incident of serious harm, we bring together those who caused the harm and all of those who've been harmed, and their respective supporters. So an average community conference may be about 12 people. And it's not uncommon in schools, like we'll get the cases of the 15-girl fights, and you get all 15 girls and all of their parents and supporters, and there could easily be 30 people in that circle. And what happens is that everybody comes together, but we do preparation and let folks know what the process is about. It's always voluntary. And they know that they're going to have a conversation about three things. The first thing they're going to talk about is what happened, and they're going to hear from the people involved in doing it. This just the story about what happened. So it's really hard for, you know, these girls to sit in a circle and to talk about just exactly what happened and where it started. And then they get to hear from every single person in that circle how they've been affected by what happened. And once everybody's had a chance to speak, the feeling in that circle really becomes very different. I mean, people really connect with each other as human beings. They are very emotional. We encourage people to say how they feel. If they're really angry, to be angry, but we don't let them attack someone else. If they start to do that, we'll redirect them and remind them that you've been asked to talk about how you've been personally affected by what happened. And then the last thing that we ask them to talk about is, what do you want to do to repair the harm and prevent this from happening again? And if they can, they'll come up with a written agreement. We use this community conferencing process as a court diversion for juvenile offenses, both felony and misdemeanor offenses. And I will say that a lot of the cases we get from the courts originated in the schools. We in Baltimore have a school police force that arrests about 50 to 100 students a month. And we're really trying to use conferencing to put a crimp on this school-to-prison pipeline. So we've been using it in schools as an alternative to suspension and arrest, and in neighborhoods and in workplaces and in a variety of other ways. But I know that we're going to focus on schools. But I just want you to know that in the 20 years we've been doing this, 18,000 people have used conferencing to successfully and safely resolve a crime and conflict themselves. 94% of the time, and this is in the land of the wire, remember, that these are in tough neighborhoods, that 94% of the time, groups have been able to come up with a written agreement that they actually abide by. And we've looked with the young people that have gone through conferencing, 60%, there's 60% lower reoffending for the kids who go through conferencing, and all at one-tenth the cost of court. So the other issue that is really important for this work is that we are using conferencing and we are using restorative practices as a way to address the racial disparities in our institutions. That there is a racial bias in terms of the kids who get suspended more often than not, and the kids who get arrested more often than not, and the kids who end up in the juvenile justice system. And this is so endemic in our society, and we have found that restorative practices is an incredibly powerful way to address that. So what I want to do is just to share a story with you about how a conference has worked in a school. We had a call from a principal who agreed to use conferencing, even for really serious things. And we always push people to use conferencing for the more serious rather than the less serious offenses, just so they can see that there is a serious, effective way to handle serious incidents of harm without using the typical punitive, alienating, separating, and punishing ways of doing things. And so this principal called us one day. I believe he called us on, it was on a Monday, and he said, "I just put 17 students out of my school. What happened was there was a fight in the morning gym class among the boys. Their girlfriends heard about that fight, and by the lunchtime, the girls got into a fight, and by the end of lunchtime, I had to put 17 kids out, and I told them they can't come to school, back to school until they do a community conference." So we immediately started calling the young people and their families to find out what was going on. And within 2 days, two evenings later, I think it was that Wednesday evening, there was a community conference with 47 people. And what everybody heard, because all the students came, the 17 students came with their family members. So it was parents, it was guardians, it was grandparents, somebody brought a pastor, and the folks from the school came that were affected by it also. And what they heard when the young people told the story is that what happened the weekend before that Monday, well, what happened the week before is that one of the kids was selling dollar candy bars to raise money. And another one of the kids took one of the bars and didn't pay the dollar. So that Saturday, the next day, the kid who was not paid his dollar went to a church party where he knew that kid was going to be, and he beat up that kid so badly that he knocked him unconscious. So on Monday, the kid who was knocked unconscious during gym class opened the door and let his cousin in, to gym class and they both beat up the other kid and it started the big fight. And that's what started and ended up with 17 kids being put out of school. So when the grandparents and the parents are hearing this story, they were incredulous. They were like, are you kidding me? This all started because of a dollar candy bar? And every single person went around the circle and talked about how they were affected by that, including younger siblings who were at the church party and what it felt like to see their brother knocked out. And by the end of it, so many of the people in that circle were in tears. The girls got a chance to have their peace and to talk about how it ended up spreading to them. And at one point when they were coming up to the agreement, the kid who had originally knocked out the other kid at the church party got up and walked across the circle, and there was this moment of like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? And he reached out his hand, and he grabbed the hand of the other kid, and he picked him up out of his chair, and he grabbed him, and he hugged him. He said, I can't believe all this started because of this. I'm so sorry. So I can't tell you how many stories there are of really complicated school conflicts that we have used community conferencing for. And what I think we've really found that happens in schools is that a lot of times what happens is whatever's done puts out the fire, but the embers are still burning. And when we finally get a referral for a community conference, and we often get the referral after 11 meetings have happened, and what happens is the fire was put out, the embers are still burning, and a little bit of sawdust goes on it, and it's all blown up again. And so what we found with community conferencing, because we get everybody there at the same time, that they're able to really get to the bottom of it, and they squash it. And we have heard from principal after principal after principal who says, you know, my policy is to not get more than two people in the room at the same time, because if I do that, there's going to be a Jerry Springer situation going on and I can't handle it. And so what I think is so important about restorative practices and about like the conferencing that we do and that the different kinds of conferences that other people do is that it gives a very simple but clear structure for people to have a conversation. You can't just pull everybody together and get them to work it out. But if there is that structure, it is amazing what people are able to do. And you never know, because you've widened the circle, you never know who in that circle is going to come through with the wisdom that's going to turn everything around. And, I mean, we did a conference where a kid bumped into another kid who was in the gang, and he was next to his pregnant girlfriend, and he took that bump incredibly seriously and knocked this kid out. And when we had the community conference, the kid who was knocked out, his father came to the conference. But what was amazing about that was serendipitously or synchronicitously, that kid's father had just gotten out of jail the day before. And he had been in a gang, and this man was tattooed up, and he had tattoo tears down his eyes, had three of them. And what he said to the kid who beat up his son in tears, he said, you do not want to go to jail. I just got out of jail. And I was in jail during my son's entire childhood doing the kinds of things that you're involved in. And let me tell you, and this man is in tears saying what it was like to miss his son's childhood while this kid across the circle is there with his girlfriend who's pregnant. And he said, don't miss your child's childhood. and he was in tears, and we had no way of knowing that this man was going to show up, and he ended up turning that kid's life around. So I think I want to see if there's any questions. It's so hard to do this.
Wow, Lauren. Goodness. Okay. I'm just so wrapped up in the stories that you're sharing. I just want to remind everybody, if you'd like to get involved in the conversation, please press 1 on your telephone keypad, as you know. Just a reminder, though, in case you didn't know that. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, please press 1 on your keypad. We have a significantly large group tonight. Don't feel shy throughout this session. I know, Lauren, you know, you have so much experience and humility. And we were talking before we came into the room tonight for this session about beginner's mind. And I appreciate that so much about you. That we're coming from a space of understanding that there's always something to be learned.
Absolutely.
Yes, we do. It's for sure. Let's hope so. It looks like at this point, let's just keep moving. But please know, everyone, that that you are certainly welcome to join in the conversation between now and the next time, perhaps, that Lauren pauses. Does that sound good to you, Lauren?
That sounds good. I just want to go through this demotion piece, which I think is just so important to this work.
Have a hand up.
Okay.
Sorry to interrupt you. We do have a hand up, so I'm going to go ahead and honor that, and then let's go back to what you were mentioning. Pardon me for interrupting.
Okay.
Kundi, I've passed
you
the mic.
Yeah, hi.
Welcome.
I do have lots of questions, but the main thing I wanted to see if I could, I can't find the way to get online to see her pictures.
And the
talk is so powerful. Thank you.
That's a great question. That is such a great question, and I always wonder if people know that we send those emails out every week to remind people about each session. And I just want to make sure you got that email. In any of the emails that you've received for any of the sessions, you will find a link to view the screen share. And I can actually, on the back end, while Lauren continues, I will find your email and I will send you that link again just to make sure. Okay, so please check your email. All right?
Yeah,
anybody else?
I actually got the email, but when I tried to open it, it said there was an error. So let's try it again.
Okay.
Thank you so
great.
Much.
Great. And while we're on this topic, we really want to hear feedback from you. And you know, if you have any questions of this nature or otherwise, info at peacealliance.org in between sessions. And certainly while we're live, if you're having technical issues, you can always email me as your host at Molly, M-O-L-L-Y, at peacealliance.org. So I'm going to go ahead and open up the mic for one more person, Lauren.
Okay.
I don't know your name because you're coming in from the generic line. But I'm going to open up your mic. If you did press 1 and would like to comment or ask a question, your line is open now. That's the generic line. Thank you.
My name is Eileen.
Great. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. So first of all, I'm a native of Baltimore, although I live in California now, and I've been following your organization for a while online, and I'm so excited that you're there. So I wanted to say that.
Awesome.
And also, I didn't know that you were coming from the background of the biology of us as human beings and why this works so well, because it supports who we are naturally. And I just love that that's your foundation, and because I believe this is why this works, because I work with animals and horses in particular that are herd animals, and it's because of my work with them, because of how their social life works, even though they're different in some ways, they're mammals. And I see how powerful it is, how you can just visually see how they are, since they don't use words and it's all body language, how important this is to them. And we're the same way. Like, we feel better when we're with our friends, and they feel better when they're with their friends. And it just makes so much sense. And it makes sense that we've forgotten who we are because we're not connected to nature anymore.
Yeah.
So I feel like supportive practices really bring us back to our nature, and which is what you said so beautifully, and it just makes me feel good to hear somebody say that.
Thank you so much. It makes me feel good to hear how different people connect with it, and I know that work with horses is so powerful, so I know that you feel what this is about. And, you know, that's actually a good lead-in to one of the issues that I think people may have a sense of, but in this country, you know, in the last few years, there's been just a burgeoning of school systems talking about restorative practices. And that's been awesome in so many ways, and it's been a little bit, I don't know what the word is, disheartening in some ways, because, like, even in Maryland, our State Department of Education wrote into the guidelines for discipline all about restorative practices, and that happened last year. But there is absolutely zero funding from the state level for schools to get training in it and to support it. And so what I've seen happen a lot, which I've heard around the country that this is not uncommon, is that a lot of people in education are talking about restorative practices, but there's this push to do it without the, you know, you can't just like go to a one-day training and then go back to your school and get it all. As we've all, you know, learned, this is about changing a culture. This isn't about just implementing something new that is like this little technique to do. And so what I've seen is that one of the things that we have been really careful to safeguard, and I'm going to go through why I think this is so important, but if restorative practices become a technique without feeling, then I feel like we may as well not do it. And I've seen circles where the teacher circles the students up and says, okay, tell me one thing about this program that you're in that you like, and everybody goes around and says one word, and most of the kids say the same word, and that's their circle. And there's no genuine you know, feeling to it, and there's no space for the kids to just show up and just talk about what's important to them. And if that doesn't, if there can't be a space for there to be authenticity and for there to be emotion and for there to be meaning, to me, that's what the restorative practices are about. And so I hope that the woman who we talked to first has her visuals, because I'm going to go through some pictures. And they're going to be pictures of either animals or infants. And I want you to, as you see the picture, this is a lot funner to do if you can respond to this live. But it's
Lauren,
hard to
Lauren
do
can I pause?
Yeah?
Pardon me, Lauren. Let me pause you, if I might, just for a moment. Just on that note, if there's anybody else with us tonight that is not on the visual and needs help, feel free to email me right now. Since I'm live with you, I know how to access your email, and I can send you the link that I just sent Kundi, and it looks like she's all up and running now. So if anyone else needs help, Molly, M-O-L-L-Y, at peacealliance.org. That's all one word, peacealliance.org.
All right, so I'm going to hold off with the pictures, and we'll go through some other stuff, and we'll save that fun part for the end to make sure that folks are plugged in. Okay? That makes sense, Molly?
Okay, that's fine. I'm not seeing anybody raise their hand at this time, so I'm going to go on the assumption that, you know, it's your call, Lauren, whatever you would like to do. But it looks like we're good to go with people on the screen share tonight.
Okay. All right. Well, let's do some of all right, I'll go back to it. If you'll bear with me. Because this is really this is really where I come from with this work. And so as you see here, there's a rather snarly little fella there that is showing an emotion that we actually don't have a word for. The word was made up. But aside from him giving us the finger, you can see the curled lip. And what this little guy is showing is it's like when something smells bad. And so let's call that dismell, okay? And if you look at that emotional expression, that is, bleh. So that is disgust. And here we have the most common sources of what for children? Of fear, Santa and the doctor. And you can see that look of terror in that little guy's face. Now here we have the bared teeth and the knit brow, and if you could see his fists, they're probably clenched. So that's the look of anger. And here is, you can see across three generations actually, the look of sadness. Now this one's a little complicated, but this is the classic expression for shame, and I'm going to talk about that in a second. And here are some beautiful examples of surprise. And when I show this, people say, oh, that's happy. Well, if that's happy, what's that? So this is actually the look of joy. And that is actually the other positive emotion that we have, which is actually the look of interest. And so the question that I ask people is, how did those little babies know how to make faces that most of us can recognize? Those complicated facial expressions. And the fact is that we're born with the apps for each of those emotions. And I got a profound appreciation of this because I had the amazing gift in my life to work for the last 2 years of his life with a brilliant psychologist named Sylvan Tompkins. And Tompkins understood, he wrote a 4-volume set that is very dense and full of golden nuggets of understanding human behavior called Affect Imagery Consciousness. And what Tompkins started writing about in the 50s flew in the face of Freud, it flew in the face of Skinner, and what he did was he drew from Charles Darwin and basically said that the fundamental motivational system in human beings is our emotion system. And what Darwin said in the 1870s was the same thing, was that mammals have emotions for fundamental reasons that help us survive. And the two main functions of emotion that Darwin said was one was for communication, that we've got those facial expressions so that we could communicate with each other. But Darwin said, actually, that's not the primary reason biologically why we have emotions. He thought the main reason is that emotions served what he called a preparatory function. So is that they prepare us, that each innate emotion that we're born with prepares us to act in a way that helps us survive. So if we just go through like this dismal look, which is the classic look on Dick Cheney's face, the motivation associated with the smell is that stinks. Keep that the freak away from me. And that helps us survive to stay away from something that's noxious. And I'm just going to go through these. So disgust, the motivation behind disgust is you've taken it in, you ate that tuna salad sandwich that you thought was going to be good. It turned out it was sitting in the sun for too long. And 3 hours later, you've got to get rid of it. And so disgust is the motivation there is to get rid of it. You know, somebody says, oh, that's disgusting. They're trying to eject that from having thought about that, whatever that is. Anger, the motivation, we all know that the anger prepares us to attack. And there's this amazing cascade of physiological responses that our brow knits, our pupils constrict so that we can see our enemy straight ahead of us very clearly, our teeth are bared, our heart is pumping blood into our muscles and preparing us to attack. As opposed to fear, which prepares us to get the heck out of there. And so anybody in law enforcement knows that if somebody is terrified, often biologically what will happen is their bowels will evacuate to lighten the load so they can get the heck out of there quicker. It's a biologically programmed response. And the motivation behind each of these helps us survive. So with sadness, the motivation behind that sadness motivates us to seek out comfort and to get comfort. And shame is an interesting one that Tompkins, I think, had a brilliant insight. I mean, shame is sort of that feeling of deflation. And I think the kicked dog look is a perfect capturing of shame. And what Tompkins' insight was that shame comes about only in the presence of a positive bond or connection with something or someone, and when there's a perceived barrier to that connection. And so with genuine shame, because there's been a positive connection, the motivation is actually to seek to restore that bond. And I think the kicked dog, you know, not only does its head drops and its tail drops and it kind of slinks away, but you can see with this dog there, it's actually looking back like, can I come back, please? And so shame, Tompkins thought, was actually one of the least toxic of our negative emotions, because the motivation is to seek to restore that connection. Surprise biologically is basically the reset button. It orients us to stop, look, and listen. There's something here I need to pay attention to. And then we get to the two innate positive emotions that we're born with. Interest, which motivates us to engage. And I always say, if we only had an education system that was simply focused on maximizing interest in students, they would be motivated to learn and the rest of it would be easy. And then joy is that emotion that motivates us to affiliate with each other and connect. And the the thing that I think is so important about this, obviously, that this is who we are born with these apps, and what does our society tell us to do with all these emotions? In this culture, the dominant culture in this country tells us to put a lid on it, and we suffer physiologically because of that. And I can tell you, I worked in a behavioral medicine clinic, and I saw the jaw problems and the gut problems and all the things that, physiological ailments that people have because of putting a lid on their feelings. And we suffer as a society because of it. But the other aspect of this is that when harm has been done, what people are feeling is dismal and disgust and anger and fear. They're feeling biologically and with very good reason these negative feelings that are motivating us to be in conflict with each other. And what I think is happening in a community conference, which I think is so fundamentally beautiful and important, is that we're creating a safe space for people to come together and to actually give voice to what they're feeling. And they're not only given permission to, but they're encouraged to. And not only to tell their own story about how they feel, but to listen to every single other body in that circle and to give them a chance to say how they've been feeling. And once the stories start coming out, then the tears start happening. And they go around the circle, and then there's this moment in a community conference, which one Native American woman called a moment of collective vulnerability, that these circles are not about blaming one person who caused harm. It is about that entire circle of people who at some point recognize that they are each responsible for what's been going on. And there is often in conferences this palpable moment of deflation, that everybody can be angry and yelling, and then at some point somebody says something and it's like, holy crap, we are all in this together and we damn well better figure it out. And that is this amazing shift emotionally and motivationally in that circle, when people are actually surprised that they care about that kid who stole their car. And then we ask them, what do you want to do to fix this? And then all the positive emotions are engaged. They're actually interested in each other. And they figure out an agreement. And in Baltimore, in the land of the wire, 18,000 people have come up with an agreement to fix these serious crimes and conflicts that they actually abide by. So I think really what's happening with this process fundamentally is about our biology, that people have had a chance, human beings have had a chance to transform the negative emotions that motivate us to be in conflict with each other, and that there's allowed to be a shift into the positive emotions that motivate us to be in cooperation with one another. So I guess I'll stop for a second there and see if anybody has any questions.
Wonderful. And again, just pressing one on your keypad if you'd like to join the conversation.
So I can let that marinate.
We have a couple questions.
Okay.
So I am going to go ahead and pass the mic, if I might, Lauren. And so much amazing information we've covered so far here. I'm opening up the mic for Elizabeth. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Molly. Hi, Lauren. Lauren,
hey.
I am... just entranced with everything that's being said tonight, and you know, and it just evokes all the hopefulness is there, keeping in mind the respect with, you know, there needs to be training with this, there needs to be opportunity for practicing it with fidelity, and is there a structure that you will share with us? Or is that part of what you were, I think you were beginning to talk about, there are pieces that, I don't think the word you used was protected, but just wanting to keep this process safe and true. But is there a starting point for those of us branching into this?
I mean, you're probably already there. I think the starting point is caring. And what I think is also important is to have a structure that makes sense to you, and that you can build a practice within that. I mean, so that's one of the slides that is going to come up, and we may as well talk about it now, is, like, I call it the illusion of technique. That, you know, I could give you a script for a community conference that we use, but that's not going to, you know, I think there's some people that approach this work as, like, it's a recipe, and you just follow the recipe, and that's how we do this work. And we don't do it that way. We actually base our work more on understanding, like when we do our facilitator training or when we do any of our restorative practices training, we always weave in understanding the values behind this. Kay Prannis, who you all have heard from, you know, she sees the values as being the roots, I think, of the tree. And then the branches are the different practices that people have. But if you don't have the roots, that tree is not going to stand tall, and it's not going to last. So
I think here is maybe the question that I'm grappling with through this entire series, is that if there is a strong process with this in my area, I'm not aware of it, and I am involved in circle keeping. We have a community of circle keepers that are very involved in community, but not with school systems necessarily. And I know that there can, I know from our shared passions that there is overlap with that. However, can somebody who is involved in this system, and so, example me, but someone who would also be associated with some of the things that are not the most positive within our school systems, can that person be effective in leading these processes? Because I would really like to begin branching out to that, but I have been concerned about whether me being involved in the school system itself can also be the one who initiates this, facilitates it, gets it going.
Yeah.
I know I would be a good person for that because I have passion for it and I want to see it happen, but I'm concerned that just by my association within the school system that might be offsetting for some of the ones who would be involved.
What is your role in the school system?
A teacher.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. The way that I've approached this over the past over 20 years now is I've tried to find fertile ground. I think that, you know, I don't want to scare people away from doing this either. I don't think it's, you know, I think if you care and you learn a practice, then you just build it over time and you'll be guided. If you, you know, if you're grounded in these values, you'll be guided in really good ways.
Okay.
What I find really challenging about working in schools is that in contrast to the juvenile or criminal justice system, is that the schools are both centralized and decentralized. Like, there's a district office that's centralized, but we all know that every school is run by a principal, and they determine the climate of that, you know, kingdom or queendom, basically. And right. What I've tried to do is to just try to sniff out fertile ground.
I think that's a good starting point. I just want to honor the process with this, but I think that there also just needs to be a starting point, and maybe it's time to just start.
Yeah, and, you know, as we learn it by doing it, and we make the road by walking, like,
right.
Go with your instincts, and you'll know where it's working and where it's fitting, and if it's not, then maybe you can just sort of, like, turn a couple degrees and see if there's a better place somewhere else, even within the
right.
same school. But
right.
you do need to find somebody who is, you know, going to be supportive of it on some level.
Right. Thank you for your energy. I appreciate it.
Well, sure. Thank you. Good luck. Where are you?
In Ohio, in Kettering, Ohio.
Okay. There's a lot of stuff going on in Ohio. So you can be in touch.
Yeah, would you have links for that? Would you be able to include that later when Molly can put all of the information up?
I don't have them personally, but I'm sure if you Google restorative practices in schools in Ohio, there are large groups there.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah, sure.
I would love to share too, Elizabeth, and for everyone, again, that there's a clickable map at restorativejusticeontherise.org. Although it may not be all-inclusive of everything that's going on in every single state, and that we, of course, would like it to be more global, there are many links there of great organizations that are local to you. So I'm not looking at that map right now for Ohio, but you might go over there at your convenience and check that out. I'm going to go ahead and pass the mic again, Lauren, if that's all right with you, for one more.
Yep.
Louise, welcome. Louise.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for picking me up. I'm actually in Canada. I want to say that I've done this work for some time as well, but I've never quite heard it said in this manner. The biology, the shift in emotions. You know, I have always worked from a script only to make sure that I cover the framework that is in front of me, but I have deviated off the script, like you said, to kind of weave in the understandings that are underneath there. But I have never quite heard it described this way, and never, although felt it a million times, never heard it said as a moment of collective vulnerability. That's amazing to me, and I just wanted to say thank you, and I really appreciate this session. Really, really
that's
valuable.
That's awesome. Thank you. That was actually a Huron woman from Canada who made that observation.
Maybe that's why it touches me. I don't know.
Yeah. But I just honor, in terms of the lineage that I come from, I really honor Sylvan Tompkins and his just profound understanding of human beings. I mean, he was really amazing. And so that's how I got to this work. And the other aspect is from across the planet, from the Maori and from the folks in Australia. So
yeah, really.
It takes a global village.
I agree. And I just want to say, I'm not so sure that it's a bad thing, like I said, to follow a script, especially for those just starting out. Do you think just to have that kind of framework underneath you and the confidence to go forward in a circle and knowing that if you, I would say when I taught, I would say to the people, follow the script, because that will give you the basic, like I said, the confidence, the framework. If you do it, the process will follow through. like you said, those moments where you turn to from the people that have done the harm to the people that have been harmed, in those moments you actually see that biology shift, as you call it.
Yep.
And so, you know, I would say to them, trust in the process, because what you're doing here will work out. And then as you get more confidence, then you can deviate a bit. But for those
yep.
just starting out, like the last woman that spoke, you know, it's a good thing to stick with something so that you
yep.
You feel good about what you're doing, knowing that it will work.
Absolutely. And
yeah,
and when we do our training, you know, we go through the script and we just talk about why it's laid out the way it is, and and we talk about what questions are asked, and we also talk about why we don't ask other questions.
Right, and why we ask in a particular order, and
exactly
what we're trying to
yep.
get with that, and
yep.
and there's probably lots of scripts and stuff you can get online for people that want to see what we're talking about. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Louise. And Lauren, we do have another hand up. Can we take one more question before
sure.
you move forward?
Yeah.
It'd be
sure.
great. Passing the mic to Allison. Welcome, Allison.
Hi.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. So my question goes back to the questions that you use in your community circles. You know, when you were building your systems, I'm just wondering how you decided to use those particular questions. you know, you were talking about how it's not a script, and just now, you know, our friend in Canada was saying, well, sometimes there's a good reason to start with particular questions that we ask and, you know, to provide some structure, as you said earlier. And I wondered, you know, why you chose those particular questions and not questions about people's motivations, what they were going for when they acted, and things like that. So if you could just share with us some of how you've decided to use those questions, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Sure. Well, I learned this practice from David Moore in Australia, and he has such an amazing understanding of this, you know. The questions we ask are basically what happened, hearing how everybody's been affected by it, and then asking the group what can be done to repair the harm and prevent it from happening again. And, you know, David taught me and taught us that that's basically going through the past, the present, and the future, and there's a certain flow to that that is really fundamentally helpful. But I should say, we do use the script, but what I say to folks is the first three times you do a conference, stick to the script. But we go mm-hmm. through and understand why, like we don't ask people, why did you do this?
Mm-hmm.
For a very basic reason. Most of us don't know why we do what we do most of the time. And that's just
mm-hmm.
a fact. Somebody once said that we walk through life unconsciously motivated and consciously confused. and so we want to engender conversation. So if you're going to ask somebody why you did it and they really genuinely don't know, they're just going to get defensive.
Sure. I wasn't actually suggesting that people ask the why question, because I know that so likely to make people feel defensive. But, you know, one of the questions in Dominic Barter's classic questions for a restorative circle is what were you looking for when you chose to act, which
mm-hmm.
is less likely to get people defensive and does get at
yeah.
a little bit of what they were consciously looking for or wanting
yeah.
when they did whatever they did, whether they were considered
I mean,
as... Mm-hmm.
My feeling is, I love the Rumi quote that there are 1,000 ways to kneel and kiss the earth. I mean, there are so many ways to do circle process. I don't think there's one right way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't, it's probably not, it would take a lot of time to go through every process and to talk about why this and why that. So this is the way I learned it, and it really works. And I, you know, as David Moore says, that those three questions are just are elegantly designed and deceptively simple.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the process that I learned about that I gravitated to.
Mm-hmm. And it's worked for your community.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the best inarticulate answer I can give to that.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Allison, thank you. And would you mind sharing what part of the world you're connecting in from? Just so everyone has a sense of...
Mm-hmm. Yep, I'm in Northeast Missouri, U.S.
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
You know, I want to sneak something in here real quick.
Lauren, carry on. Yes, please. Go right ahead.
Well, there's so much, you know, trauma-informed approaches have become de rigueur and are really important. And at the same time, I'm starting to hear from teachers that they're feeling like they keep hearing about ACEs and they keep hearing about the impact of trauma, and they're incredibly frustrated because feel like they're not given tools of like, okay, so now what do we do? And so I think that inadvertently we're putting some pressures on teachers that I've just heard so many teachers be frustrated by the pressure they're feeling to be trauma-informed. And so I just want to say that I feel that restorative practices have always been deeply rooted in a trauma-informed and trauma-sensitive approach, because it's about providing a safe space. Like, as mammals, we need to feel safe. And circles provide a consistency, and these are all things that we've learned, especially from returning soldiers with PTSD, that ritual is really important. And in schools, I don't talk about ritual, but I talk about creating consistency so that kids who are feeling trauma and traumatized and toxically stressed have a safe space. They know what they can anticipate. And then, you know, that there's a saying in trauma practice about feelings, that you got to name it to tame it. And circles, fundamentally, if they're done well, then participants have a space to name how they're feeling, which our culture typically doesn't give us a chance to do. So I just wanted to throw that in there, because I'm hearing this a lot from teachers, that they're really stressed out by this new movement around trauma-informed care and practice. Okay, Molly. I'm done.
Well, wonderful. Thank you, Lauren. If you would like to proceed.
Yes.
I think that would be great, given that we have about 7 minutes, technically, before we close session for the evening. So please continue.
I talked a little bit about the illusion of technique, that this is really not about a technique. It's an approach and its values. But one thing that I want to share that I think is so underutilized in schools in general, and especially with the restorative practices, is the importance of peer learning and creating peer learning communities. So wherever you are, if you're learning or practicing restorative practices, I think it's so helpful to create spaces where we can learn with and from each other. Like the groups that we have trained in community conferencing, we have a web-based call once a month, and where we talk about program implementation issues, and then we talk about the actual process, like a case, we review a case. And we just learn so much from each other. I've been doing this for 20 years, and I'm still learning a lot. Like, this is not, you get trained and you know it. I mean, it's an ongoing practice, and I just really encourage people who are doing this to try to connect with their peers so that you're not alone in developing it. And like with everything, just self-care is so important. I know that there's so many educators and administrators out there that are feeling so stressed, and our bodies don't like to have cortisol squirting and squeezing out of our adrenal glands all the time. It's incredibly damaging to our immune system, to our heart, to our, it just leads to so many health complications. So if I can leave the group with anything, I think we all experience, especially in schools, the frustrations of what it's like to try to bake into an institution that is operating on a pedagogy that was created in the 1900s to create good factory workers, and we're trying to bake into it something that's very different, and it's incredibly stressful. So I encourage everybody to take good care of yourselves. Love to get another question if there is one.
Wonderful. So again, if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question as we come towards the closing of to this evening or wherever you're connecting in from the world, because we do have a global learning community here. I want to be honoring of the fact that I certainly am not a U.S.-centric host for you all. So do press 1 on your keypad, and we'll pass the mic. And Mike is coming to you, Susan. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm really enjoying tonight. I'm getting so much out of it, and I know I'll be listening to this again as soon as it's posted. I'm a teacher. I'm in Gainesville, Florida. And over the last 8 years or so, I've been slowly changing my classroom. And it's become a very calm place, and the kids even notice when they first come in the first part of the school year. And you were talking about trauma, and most of my kids are the real at-risk youth that have been through a lot of trauma. And it has been amazing how the setting and, you know, whether I'm calm or not too, creates an atmosphere where they do feel safe and are then willing to talk. And it's kept down the referrals. I don't write these guys up, you know, maybe one or two so far this year. And whereas before, I was writing them up left and right. And they're willing to talk. And so I've been trying to bring the restorative justice part and stuff to the school, and they're kind of shut down. We're really lucky to have the River Phoenix Center here, and I was able to get a hold of Jeff, and so he's trying to help me wedge a way into our school, because I think it would make such a difference, and I see the little bit I'm doing in the classroom making a difference, and I want to take my training further. Not quite sure where to go to get the further, so I'm kind of picking things where I get here and there.
That's great. I know that the River Phoenix Center for Peace Building has a lot of different workshops that they offer. We have been down there
really
twice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
I was really hoping to go to the immersion training in May. But I have physical limitations, and it's on the second floor, so I won't be able to go. I'm so disappointed because I really wanted to do the May and October immersion training because that just sounds wonderful.
Yep.
So, but yeah, they're a great resource.
Yep. And folks are welcome to come to Baltimore, or we will come to schools. Schools across the country have asked us to come and, mm-hmm. and provide trainings, and so we do that when we can.
And it's helpful when you come into the school. And I yep. will admit our school is very resistant, and so I feel like I'm pecking at the shell. But I'm getting
yeah.
shells opening up. I mean, they are actually paying so I could go to this tonight. So
well, that's great.
That's a step in, and I'm just pushing it.
As Tompkins used to say, small steps for little feet.
Hmm. Susan, thank you so much, and I just want to throw in there for you, Susan, and for everyone, although it's no replacement for an on-the-ground training, the Peace Alliance and the NACRJ are going to continue to offer a 201-style orientational training with a couple different faculty throughout the rest of this year. So I'm looking forward to being able to provide more information about that. And I highly recommend if you can catch Lauren, given your schedule, Lauren, but you do have on-the-ground trainings that are regularly offered up there, and more can be found out about that, I'm assuming, at communityconferencing.org, right? Is that correct?
Yep.
And we are going to be running over just a slight bit. I know that many of you might need to leave. Want to be time sensitive here for everyone. I know there's still hands up for questions, so I just want to take a moment to check in with you, Lauren, and see if you might be willing to field a couple more questions.
I'm good if you're a few minutes late. Yeah,
I'm good. I'm honoring a people's time, and I want to say my closing announcements before
yep.
people that do need to hop off do. So let me just do that, and then we'll come back to the people that still have their hands up.
Okay.
I want to thank the NACRJ again, National Association of Community and Restorative Justice, and the Peace Alliance, the primary host, for this extraordinary journey that we've been on for 10 weeks here with Teaching Peace in Schools, an overview course, and I want to thank also all of our affiliate partners, various organizations across the country and beyond who have helped this to be possible. I'd like to just mention again, as I did at the top of the hour, that Fania Davis will be joining us as guest faculty next Thursday, that's April 7th, at our same time frame. And finally, if you haven't already, please fill out our participant survey so that we know what we've been doing well, how we can improve for the future for offerings that are upcoming, and what you might be interested in most as it applies to your professional continuing education and your needs in your community. We want to make sure that we can hopefully meet needs as best we can surrounding online courses, again, knowing that there's a lot that can also and naturally is done in connecting with trainings on the ground in person and connecting with peers, as Lauren so eloquently has emphasized tonight. So I think that concludes my announcements for closing. I want to thank you again for being with us in this 10 weeks, and also just remind you that the final session will be after this next week with Fania. We'll have one more session with Jeffrey Weisberg from the River Phoenix Center for Peacebuilding. So we're really looking forward to hearing from him as well, and he will be going into social-emotional learning and how it interweaves with restorative practices. So I'm going to go ahead, Lauren, and now open up the mic again and pass it to Dorothy. Welcome, Dorothy.
Hi. I'm completely brand new to this, and I do not have people to connect with. And because trauma was brought up, I'm trying to, in my mind, picture what you do in a circle if someone who has been traumatized really loses it. Do you escort them out of the room and help them get back in touch with themselves, or how do you handle a situation like that where someone is just so traumatized?
I don't think there's any one way to do that. I think that some of the amazing things that happen in circles, especially with young people, is that they intuitively know how to take care of each other. And I've seen it over and over again where somebody really breaks down and their peers literally and figuratively put their arms around them and give them what they need to, at least in that moment, to let them know that they're safe and to let them know that they're cared for. And there's, you know, like Molly and other people have said, to trust the process, that circles are not about the facilitator fixing everything. And so there may be something that comes up, and if as the adult, as the facilitator, if you're really concerned, you can let everybody know, and especially let that person in the circle, that young person, know that we will take care of this, that this is not going to end here, and we will get you the help that you need. And sometimes that's all you need to say.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Dorothy. I'm going to go ahead and pass the mic to Tina. Welcome, Tina.
Thanks, Molly. I'm in Texas, near Houston, Texas, and I've just recently moved here. But my background mostly for this work is, where I used to live near Cincinnati, I was involved with social-emotional learning in the schools. And I have a background as a volunteer community mediator. And I really enjoyed, Lauren, what you were saying about transformative justice, because I'm trained in transformative mediation. And I saw over and over again how having trust in the parties, of course, mediation, it generally was two parties. You know, it would be victim, offender, or you know, parent, child, or that kind of thing. But sometimes there would be, like you mentioned, the fight, you know, and there may be more participants and their grandma, spouse, or, you know, parents. And it got kind of, you know, it was more like a conferencing or a circle in a way. But what I was wondering is, you had spoke about the seeing the emotions move from the negative ones of the fear and the anger and all of that, and then transforming into the interest, you know, in the caring for one another. It's that seems really it aligned with our training in transformative mediation, where we talk about the parties at first are in conflict, so they're self-absorbed and they're weak. You know, they feel weak inside, and in the process of having a different kind of conversation that is facilitated, and the mediator helps by reflecting and summarizing and not telling them what to do at all, but just helps them have that conversation that they need to, they become like they are stronger, they feel empowered, and they are relational. They can reach out and recognize the other party as a human, as a person, you know. And so kind of with what Dorothy had said, in the processes that you do, is there guidelines or in the opening or anything about how people need to speak respectfully to one another, or do you sort of more rely on the questions and the process, and just that whoever's there, that you know, they'll have what they need to you know, to have their conversations?
I think if I understand your question, I mean we pretty much let them have the conversations that they need to have within that structure of hearing what happened, letting everybody say how they've been affected, and then having the group decide how to move forward in a better way. So are the rules. Those are pretty much the rules. And then if something comes up during the conversation that's concerning somebody about how they're being spoken to, we'll just put it back to the group and say, well, what do you want to do about that?
Yeah, I see. I so appreciate and grok with this, because I've also had some training or been involved in mediation that's more, what is that called, facilitative or directive, where the whole, you know, the goal is to get an agreement, and a lot of times the mediator is, quote-unquote, helping these people, you know, to in a way that's kind of more, yes, you know, it's directive, and it's not relying on that they have inside of them what is what it takes, you know, to resolve or transform this conflict. And also the whole guidelines in the beginning of some sort of mediation, well, no shouting, no cursing, speak to each other respectfully. But I've found that, well, sometimes in what we would do is just ask them, you know, ask the party, how would you like to, would you like to have, you know, sort of guidelines or not? And so what I hear with your process is it's more like that. It's really based on it's rooted in those values, and it, you know, everything goes from there. You know, the people that are in the room are the ones that decide. I just wanted to say that I really appreciate that, that openness kind of, you know, and that trust.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you so much, Tina. And if there's any further questions, feel free to press 1 on your keypad. And while we're pausing for any further questions, I just want to thank you again, Lauren, for the time and devotion over so many decades, and certainly for tonight, for spending time with us here on this course, and just honoring you and thanking you for everything you've done. And a reminder for those of you who have not seen Fixing Juvie Justice, Lauren, maybe do you happen to know if that's circulating still? Hopefully it is. That was a question I wanted to ask you.
Unfortunately, PBS has not yet made it available. I'm not sure why.
That's a shame. That's such a shame, because we're talking about an hour documentary that is very powerful. If you haven't seen it, I hope we can get that fixed at some point so that people can see that.
Yeah. If somebody's interested, they should probably contact me and I can help out.
Okay. Wonderful. And on that note, is there a way that you might like to stay in direct contact with people? If you'd like to share that now, and we also certainly, after we close tonight, as we do with every session, we'll have resources and links, and of course the slide presentation and the audio from tonight's session posted at peacealliance.org/teach-course-page. I know most of you probably have this memorized, but just in case. And the password to enter into the Learning Community Hub, where all these resources are posted, is Peace is the Way. And also, I forgot to mention that survey, it's just 10 questions. It's not very long to take it, fill it out, is posted. A link to it is posted at the top of that page. So if you would please help us to understand how we've done this 10 weeks and what you might be looking for in the future, if anything, and also any kind of feedback. We like to know how we can improve as well. So it looks like that wraps it for questions and for conversation tonight, Lauren. I just want to thank you again so much on behalf of the Peace Alliance and the NACRJ for being with us tonight. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you all. Thank you so much, Molly.
And everyone, we'll see you next week for Fania Davis on Thursday, April 7th, same time slot. Have a great rest of your week, and thanks for all you do in the field that you're in. And we'll see you next week. Thank you very much. Good night.
Good night.